got tonight in Genesis 1, verse 28. We read, "And God blessed them, and God said unto them, Be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth." And in 1 Timothy 2, verse 15, we read, "And notwithstanding she," that is, the God-fearing woman, "she shall be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith and charity and holiness with sobriety." In our study of the Christian home, we have come to appreciate the tension that exists between sin and grace as it relates to our homes. And we have come to appreciate the tension that exists in so many ways. In our outlook, for example, concerning marriage itself, we live in a society that tries to explain away the need for marriage and talks about lifestyles and different possibilities whereby people can live together if they want to. And that over against that, we have seen that the Word of God instructs us that if a man and a woman desire to live together, God requires of them to be married to each other. That marriage is God's divine institution whereby man and woman live together. That creates an element of tension. Tension as we strive to grapple with the meaning of this in the day and age in which we live. In preparation for that marriage, we realize, of course, that the world has quite a different idea about the relationships of male and female. That because they don't think of it as an opportunity to prepare for marriage, the world at large round about us thinks of the relationship of men and women casually. So that it is very common today that a man and a woman live together without being married. That if there is an element of courtship today, it is viewed simply as an opportunity to become acquainted with each other, also sexually. So that in our promiscuous society, values are attacked. Christian values are attacked. And therein lies the tension. That the Christian understands that courtship is preparation for marriage. It is to determine whether or not it is God's will for a young man or woman to become married to anybody. And ultimately, it is the purpose of God to guide a young man and woman whether or not it is God's will for a particular man and a particular woman to be married to each other. That's serious business. That's an important time. The foundations of marriage are already laid in the important time of courtship. When it is the will of the Lord to be married, a husband experiences the tension that he feels for himself over against the will of God. There are husbands who are only too eager to become the heads of their wives. But they have an unbiblical concept of that headship. They want to rule. They want to have the say. They want to be tyrants. Other fickle men refuse to be heads. They would gladly let their wives run the whole works, the family and everything, and they simply take it easy. Both of which are violations of the will of God. And in the will of God sets forth the headship of the husband, he does it with the glorious mandate that the husband love his wife, and the headship must be a loving relationship of rule and of management. And that creates tension. the role of the wife, laid out in the Holy Scriptures, that she is to be in submission to her husband and obey him in everything. The only exception is if the husband requires of her to sin. It's in our day and age when the woman is told she is at least equal with the man, and many women aren't satisfied with equality. They want to have all the say. And in that environment, there is tension in the role of the Christian wife. And we have seen that it is a great privilege to be a child of God, whereby we have rehearsed repeatedly that the spiritual impetus for the Christian to understand these things is the spiritual union which we have with Jesus Christ. Because we are married to Christ, bone of his bone and flesh of his flesh, we have a spiritual power within us that helps us to put down the old man of sin, to crucify it, to say no to that which would violate the will of God, and to glory in God's will for us in all our relationships in the home. This evening, that same tension becomes evident when we have to deal with children. Tonight, I'm not going to concentrate, first of all, on how God instructs a father to be a father. The Lord willing, we hope to do that. Or a mother to be a mother. This is rather a general treatment of the question as to how we are to value children. And that, too, is in the world that produces tension. But let's look at that tonight, then, as God instructs. And that particularly I want to apply now to the husband and to the father. A divine command: be fruitful, multiply, replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over it. There lies a beautiful instruction to the God-fearing husband. What we call the cultural mandate. Inseparably connected with that is the divine command to have children. To the Christian wife, that beautiful word which God gives us through Timothy, having spelled out the fact that the woman is to be in subjection and quiet in the church, asserting that Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived was in transgression, nevertheless, notwithstanding, she shall be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith and charity and holiness with sobriety. If we can put these two passages together in perspective, then we certainly can see tonight the blessing of children. Notice then, first of all, the reason why children are a blessing. Let's notice, secondly, the expression of that blessing of children, and finally, that it is an abiding joy, not just a momentary joy to have children, but it abides all through life and unto eternity. The glaring evidence of the decadence of society is the attitude of the general public towards children. I don't have to spell it out with all kinds of examples. If you read the papers, if you are in contact with the media today, all kinds of horror stories are reported to us of what happens concerning men and women's attitudes towards children. Many openly speak of refusal to have any children. In a past generation, that was considered to be so private that no one would even talk about it. But in today's society, that's open conversation. You, in your contact with the world, whether it may be in a neighbor, maybe it was someone on the job, or some contact you may have even with relatives, repeatedly, we hear, I do too, we hear people openly say, we don't want to have any children. Then there are those who say and even criticize us for having children. that there is a hostility, a bitterness. And they too are very open to tell us that, almost either by implication or by assertion. They say to us, who do we think we are having children? They judge us in our bearing children. And looking at that, and you ask the question, what are the reasons for some of this? It's interesting to notice that in trying to assert some kind of a plausible explanation why not to have children, you have in American society today an element that talks about the fact that the world is overpopulated. No denying that there are some countries, particularly third world countries, that are overpopulated. And the serious concern for overpopulation is very real. It's rather striking that here in America, the land of opportunity, the land in which our farmers are producing more than can even be consumed, that we do hear that kind of talk, kind of superficial talk, oh, we're concerned about the population of the world. Way back in 1759, a gentleman by the name of Malthus predicted that on the basis of the population increase of the world and food production, the world eventually was going to starve itself to death. Now that has, of course, made an impact upon society. And all you have to see, of course, is in third world countries, a reality of much of that. And certainly, the fact that there are countries that have too many people for the amount of food is a very serious thing. Our value towards children doesn't flippantly deal with such an important subject. For the Christians living, for example, in third world countries, it is a very real issue. But we're living here. It's here in America, the land of plenty. So that when you deal with the question, what about children? Why don't people have children today? More honesty tells us that reasons are far more selfish. Some will openly say they just don't want children because they cramp their style. These kind of people, in many ways, are honest. These are the kind of people that are career-minded. These are the people that husbands, wives, both want employment. They want to make a lot of money. They live a certain way. They want to travel. They want to have all the luxuries of life. Children cramp the style. They can't put up with children. It's an inconvenience. So they openly say they don't want children. Some of them say at best they will have one, probably two. And they use that cliche, quality over against quantity. And they speak a great deal about that. They think about only a couple of children so you can give to those children what they deserve and that you can give them a good home, you give them attention, and you can meet their needs. And on they go about the values, quality versus quantity. Much of this, of course, has motivated medical science to produce devices that meet the needs of controlling the birth of children. Striking thing, of course, is that we live in a very free and open society concerning sexual relationships. Professor Hooksma is right when in the Standard Bearer he says that many euphemisms are used today to cover up just plain fornication and adultery. We are living in a fornicating and an adulterous generation. They talk about lifestyles. They talk about human relationships. They talk about sexual activities. All those nice terms which ought to be labeled fornication and adultery. We are living in that kind of a world. And because that kind of a world wants to practice their sinful behavior, they don't want babies. They want the pleasures of sexual activity without conception. And therefore, of course, it is in that interest that all sorts of devices have been produced, chemical and otherwise, and also of late abortion devices, so that ultimately they can control what they want. If in their carelessness a child is conceived but they don't want it, they at least have the backup for abortion, and they do it legally. And that's taken place repeatedly in American society today. We don't like to think of abortion as a population control device, but it is. And we mustn't be deceived by that, because that's true. It places the Christian now before that responsibility as to how he must relate to all of this. The Christian now recognizes that there are made available to him means of birth control for the purpose of planning and spacing a family. And because that too is something that every God-fearing husband and wife must deal with, they must deal with that carefully before the living God. I'm not going to say from this pulpit it is wrong to practice birth control. Every God-fearing husband and wife must make that decision themselves. It is a very private, a very personal, a very important decision that must be made. The answer for the Christian church, and that is certainly the direction of the gospel, it's not to say whether or not we exercise family planning, but it is rather whether we have a proper value for children. Then all the rest will be answered and dealt with in God's way. When you and I, as God-fearing husbands and wives, have a right attitude towards children, we will also be able to make God-fearing decisions concerning the conception of children. That's the basic issue. And in that issue, it's important too that we understand that it is not simply the purpose of sexual activity to conceive children. That may be true for the animal world, but that's not true for human beings. Sexual activity God has certainly given to Adam and to Eve and to all husbands and wives as the intimate expression of fellowship, of friendship, of love within the marriage bond. And it isn't so that the only purpose of sexual activity is to conceive children. Part of it is, but not exclusively. God has made man and woman such that within the marriage bond, it's important for a husband and a wife to practice regular sexual relationships for each other's sake in obedience to God. Neither is it so that if God does not bless a marriage with children, the marriage is a failure. We mustn't go to the other extreme that children are so important that unless a husband and wife have children, their marriage is a failure. That's not true. If God closes the womb and doesn't give children, then a husband mustn't feel like he is not really a husband, or that he fails as a husband, or a wife cannot feel that she fails as a wife. Surely they are tested in their faith, but it isn't so that their marriage is a failure. Marriage takes prominence over parenthood. Within the relationship of marriage, when God gives a husband and wife to each other and blesses them in a good spiritual, physical relationship, they are enriched together whether they have children or not. It's evident, too, that the desire to have children was already rooted in creation. God gave to Adam and to Eve, before they fell into sin, this cultural mandate. This came to them prior to the fall. Be fruitful, multiply, replenish the earth, and subdue it. So that God made male and female with a desire for sexual relationship not only, but also with the desire for children. That is an inborn motivation. The beautiful thing, of course, is that God gave that in perfection. So that all that has to do with sex and the desire for children is not dirty. It is not filthy. It is in God's sight of great honor. Adam and Eve had a sexual relationship without any doubt before they fell into sin. But sin came. And the effect of sin upon begetting of children is very evident. The fulfillment of that so-called cultural mandate concerning Adam is given to us in Genesis 3, verse 17. And unto Adam he said, because thou hast hearkened unto the voice of thy wife, and hast eaten of the tree of which I commanded thee, saying, thou shalt not eat of it. Cursed is the ground for thy sake. In sorrow shalt thou eat of it in all the days of thy life. Thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth to thee, and thou shalt eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread, till thou return unto the ground, for out of it wast thou taken. Dust thou art, and unto dust thou shalt return. And that speaks to every husband in a very personal way. Every father in a personal way. Concerning the wife, we read in verse 16 of Genesis 3, and unto the woman he said, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children, and thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee. So that there too you can see sin affected the role of Eve becoming a mother. I will greatly increase thy conception. Now, it's hard to be positive about these things, but it would almost seem that this might explain why Adam and Eve didn't become parents at a certain time prior to the fall. That even from a physiological point of view, the probability of conceiving children changed after the fall. So that the monthly cycle of the woman perhaps became a monthly cycle after the fall. So that God says, I will increase thy conception. So that the possibility of pregnancy increased. And with it, of course, her relationship to her husband, he shall rule over thee. And bringing forth children in sorrow. Again, every God-fearing wife and mother, can I understand those words and the burden of them? But the point is that it is in Jesus Christ again that we see a perspective on parenthood. Because we personally, individually, by faith, are the bride of Jesus Christ, making up the great bride of Christ, the Son of God, and that we are engaged to him to be married when he shall return at the end of the world, now spiritually bone of his bone and flesh of his flesh. We have the spiritual understanding for parenthood. And let me put it this way. First of all, it means that we have love. There's two things I want to mention in this connection. A Christian husband and a Christian wife in their marital relationships have love. That puts a whole different dimension on that relationship. That love which God has for us, that love which is in Jesus Christ, it's that love that accompanies sex. That's precious. That's why we read in the Bible, for example, and Adam knew Eve, his wife. Now, some of the new translations put that translation, and Adam had sexual intercourse with his wife. But that's, from a certain point of view, true, because that involves the sexual relationship. But it involves more than that. As you know, the verb to know in the Bible can also be translated to love. The point is that Adam loved his wife Eve in their sexual relationship. You can have sex without love. Plenty have that in the world. But the beautiful thing within the covenant of grace and God's people married to Jesus Christ, a Christian wife and a Christian husband have sexual relationship in love, the deep spiritual love which is in Jesus Christ. You see, that becomes a spiritual motivation for parenthood. Because that love is not selfish. That love encompasses other persons. That love ultimately is the love which encompasses the living God. Love of Jesus Christ. Love of husband and wife. Love of children. The God-fearing husband and wife have the great value for children in the context of love. And that love, in the second place, is the motivation for friendship, covenantal friendship. The joy of being able to speak with one another. That's why the husband and wife in the bond of Christian love are the best friends. They communicate with each other. They cherish each other, nourish each other. That's the rich dimension of Christian marriage. And that carries over. The love that a wife and a husband have for each other is the love which they together have for their children. In the consciousness that God is a covenant God, that God is a God of friendship, not only with believers, but if the living God is pleased to give them children, to include their children. You see, when you're married to Jesus Christ, you have a different value. That love which is in Christ makes the covenant of grace so real. Not for ourselves, but for others. With that in mind, then, certainly husbands and wives recognize that children then are in truth the heritage of the Lord. Now that's a term we use repeatedly out of Psalm 127 verses 3 through 5. Lo, children are the heritage of the Lord. The fruit of the womb is his reward. Happy is the man that has his quiver full of them. From that perspective, as believers married to Jesus Christ, the ultimate object of our faith is God. We recognize as one of the great Reformed truths the sovereignty of God. We recognize that in God's sovereignty, He has from all eternity willed a people unto Himself. He has by election and reprobation determined the destiny of every rational, moral creature. That God in His own sovereignty is the sovereign Lord over the whole human race. There isn't a child conceived in the human race but under the sovereign disposition of God. Now that takes a lot of faith to believe that, but that's what we believe. That God overrules everything. That may sometimes astound us, because sometimes children are conceived in all sorts of ways and under all sorts of circumstances and between all kinds of people. But the sovereignty of God does mean that God is sovereign over the conception of the ungodly as well as the conception of the children of believers. That helps us then understand, too, that God has a purpose. We study the Word of God in the light of His sovereignty, then we can understand, too, that He has a purpose for the population explosion in this world. From a human point of view, we're frustrated by that. Every time I read about and see something about these countries where you have these poor babies starving to death, and you can have all kinds of efforts put forth on rich countries to try to help, but they are in a political situation where there is no help. And help that is given is manipulated politically. But sometimes you're frustrated, sometimes you have a guilty feeling. What is going on in this world? Babies are born, babies and more babies, and even more babies in a certain social structure. Yet under the sovereignty of God, it's striking that God has a purpose for that. We must understand that too. And we must understand, for example, that God has His own ways of population control. How often don't we read about earthquakes in these same countries when people are living in these earth huts and earthen buildings that crumble and fall beneath earthquakes, and the total of dead is so astounding you can hardly understand that thousands of people. Floods. All sorts of violence in nature. Wars. Tribal conflicts. The sovereign God also has a purpose with all of this. But also that the sovereign God has a purpose and the tension in this world between the rich and the poor. Those that are knowledgeable tell us that we better get ready because the greatest convolutions in society are going to be taking place in the very near future between the nations of the world that are rich and the poor. And that's undoubtedly true, and that's biblical. That's what we read, for example, in Revelation 6 concerning the black horse. There too, from a biblical point of view, there are those that have great wealth. The rider of the black horse is a balance. And he describes the tension between those that are poor, that earn a little bit of money to buy just enough to stay alive, and those that are rich. There's great tension between the nations of the world over this, and surely wars have been and undoubtedly will be fought over the whole struggle of riches and poverty. And all of this too is in the purpose of God. The purpose that He will shake the foundations of the world. He will show to the nations of the world that it is only in Jesus Christ and His coming that there is true love. And there is a true sharing of wealth. In the midst of all of this, the Church of Jesus Christ realizes that God instructs us to bear children. The command is given, be fruitful, multiply, replenish the earth. The command is given concerning women in 1 Timothy 5:14, I will that the younger women marry, bear children. We read in Psalm 113:9, He maketh the barren woman to keep house. That's God's sovereignty. Psalm 139, 14 through 16, glories in God's sovereignty and conception, how He forms in the womb that we are fearfully and wonderfully made, wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. All of this acknowledges the fact that God in His sovereignty instructs us to bear children. That we have that privilege, that we have that commandment, that we have that responsibility. And to see that the sovereign God has so laid that out, that the children are planned by God, the conception is under the sovereign disposition of God, they are brought forth by God, they belong to God, our children are precious for God's sake. Now from that perspective then, the God-fearing father That's a great task. Within the framework of what is called the Great Command, be fruitful, multiply, replenish the earth, and subdue it. God then instructs husbands and wives, of course, to bear children. Notice with me that the Christian husband will not say to his wife, "Honey, it's up to you whether we have another baby." That's not what the Christian husband says. God says, be fruitful, multiply, replenish the earth. Now I know he has said this to both of them, and God blessed them and said unto them. But it's evident that in this cultural command, the command comes specifically to the husband that he is to subdue the earth. That in the carrying out of this command, it is intimately connected with his responsibility to be faithful in obeying God's command to subdue it. The husband recognizes he is responsible for the conception of children. Not responsible alone, but he's responsible. Therein lies his headship again. The responsibility he must discuss with his wife. You mustn't go to the other extreme and say, the husband, because he's the head, he's going to decide whether the wife likes it or not, and no matter what she thinks, he's going to determine how many children they're going to have. Of course not. It is a mutual responsibility, but ultimately, it rests again under the headship of the husband, considering his wife. But it's not easy to be a father. When you read those words of Genesis 3, as we did 17, 18, and 19, that talks about, cursed is the ground for thy sake, thorns and thistles and sweat and sweating until you're dying, and you go to the dust, it's obvious that God, after the fall, does not view the role of the Christian husband and father in any easy way. And surely every God-fearing father today knows that that fathering carries with it a great deal of responsibility. Fathering isn't just conceiving a child. Fathering involves the care of those child conceived and born, if it's the Lord's will. It's the father who realizes that it's his responsibility before God, as he must carry out the command to subdue the earth, to pay the bills. And the father realizes that more children means more bills. More children means you need to have a bigger house. They have to have a place to sleep, a place to live together. When children come, you know good and well, that means more food, that means more clothes, that means more caring. And as they get older, that means more tuition. All of that becomes a very real thing to the father. And from a human point of view, it's understandable that every Christian father struggles with his ability to fulfill that. That's the difficulty that every Christian father faces. That's the hard reality of life. Can he meet those needs? Can he afford more? Can it work out so that a family can be provided for? And so the husband wrestles with these things. You look at the world and they simply solve it by saying, of course not, I'm just going to determine it all by the checkbook. And the checkbook that, of course, is going to be determined by so many things that have greater priority than children. The God-fearing husband and father who realizes that under the control of the sovereign God, he treasures children. You see, there's the spiritual motivation that a Christian father has a great value upon children. He cherishes them. He knows that he is happy with his quiver full of them. Because the living God is good in giving children. There are great blessings of the home. But the fact remains, He has to provide. And all kinds of idealism and all kinds of wishful thinking and so on, it cannot solve for a Christian father and husband the reality of fulfilling his responsibility to meet those needs. And that's why I say it's so beautiful to look at this cultural mandate from the Christian perspective. So often we struggle as fathers. What are we working for? But can't you see too that it is now this so-called cultural mandate that takes on precious meaning in Jesus Christ? There is no basis of culture in the world. The only culture the world knows is some kind of fraternity amongst men. Selfishness, greed, it is evident in the whole of society. And when the Christian laborer realized that it is his calling before God to be fruitful, multiply, replenish the earth, and subdue it, that he does that now not in competition with the ungodly, not trying to get his little acre of turf, but he does that in the full consciousness that Jesus Christ is the Lord of all the earth. And he's married to the Son of God. Our spiritual husband is so rich that all the world belongs to him. Now that doesn't mean we can sit and loaf and he just hands it all over to us. Of course not. It means that work takes on a spiritual dimension. The Lord Jesus commands us to work. Fulfill that cultural mandate. Subdue the earth. And that indicates to us that as we go out into this world, as we be involved in business and making money and industry and producing goods, and if we work for others, it's a beautiful thing to do. We don't say, oh, that filthy money and all this filthy world and work is nothing more than slavery. The Christian husband says, no, I'm working for the master, for my king, my husband. And all the work I do, if I'm a farmer and producing crops, or if I am teacher with the children of the covenant, or whatever it is, I'm working in a joyful activity to serve the living God, the Sovereign, who is the Father of Jesus Christ. But that makes work meaningful. Oh yes, to pay the bills, the Christian father, husband must work. It is bills, bills, and more bills, and it's work, work, and more work. But he works because he has the privilege to subdue the earth, to bring all things under the service of the Lord of glory. And when he does that, and the Lord prospers his work so that he earns money. Money which is precious. He's a steward of that which is important and of value. He doesn't love money, he loves the Lord, and he realizes money is the tool, the means whereby he can provide for the things which are precious. Then in good stewardship, he treasures children. As the Christian husband and father, he says, there's joy in going to work. There is joy because my children are precious to me. I'm fulfilling the command of the Heavenly Father to be fruitful, to multiply, to replenish and subdue the earth. Under Jesus Christ, that's a joy. And with sanctified judgment, he pursues that. With the skills and the talents that the Lord has given him, each one with what interests him and what ability he has. And to provide for these children, So you could see there's a close relationship between subduing the earth and having children. Now, obviously, in the past, it was much more clear. In the days, for example, where the majority, within society were farmers, that became evident. To fulfill the cultural mandate to be a farmer required children. Children were a great asset to help the Christian husband fulfill his mandate. In order to fulfill that cultural mandate to be a farmer, and the Lord would bless him with children, the children were a great aid to that. Within the fellowship of the family, working on the farm, working together, pulling together, they were able to do that. Now that hasn't changed completely. It happens today too, for example, that when our children are able to go out and get work. Now we're not in rural America anymore, now we're all in cities. Most of us are in cities. But when the children become of age and they can go out and get jobs, you have the very same thing. How many of our young people don't work hard to pay for their education? High school education even. That's very beautiful. That's very proper. Father has a great deal of responsibility to meet the needs of the family. If the circumstances are such that the children are able to work, you see, that's the same thing as in rural America then. Working together, helping to meet. Why? So that the father can provide within the measure that he has to meet the needs of the family, and the children also participate. So that it is in the way of begetting children that God sustains this great cultural command. It is in the way of begetting children that fathers recognize that they are nurturing the generation to come. We sang of that, didn't we? Joyful land, happy land that has children, sons and daughters, sons that rule, daughters that are of a queenly race. There's the father who works hard, slaves to pay the bills, tries desperately to make ends meet, has that privilege that these children aren't just so many animals, aren't just so many other reprobate in this world, but that if it is God's pleasure, the children of the covenant, the generation to come, the future, to mold them, to care for them, so that in the busyness of meeting their physical needs, he is most of all a God-fearing father unto them, a spiritual example, one who prays with them and nurtures them. Now the same thing is true, you see, with a mother from the perspective of 1 Timothy 2. She shall be saved in childbearing. Interesting, isn't it? That the world has the opposite suggestion for the liberation of the modern woman. What is the solution for boredom, for personal success, for self-esteem? What is the solution for the world? To give a woman something that will have meaning, fulfillment? World repeatedly says, don't tie yourself down with kids. What does God say? She'll be saved by bearing children. Oh, that doesn't take away from the reality that being a mother is very difficult. Being a mother, meeting the demands of the family, clothing them, feeding them, nurturing them, little children, every age. Oh, what a task. Little wonder that oftentimes a mother feels worn down, troubled, that the burden sometimes seems too great because of the pressures that she experiences in being a mother. And yet isn't this very precious? The solution isn't don't have any children or don't have too many children or look out. should be saved in childbearing. Now, obviously, that doesn't mean, of course, that the Christian woman is saved by having a baby. Not saved from the point of view of being reconciled to God. Just having a baby doesn't save any woman. It took on a very special meaning in the old dispensation that bearing children would ultimately bring forth the Redeemer. And there's that perspective also in the new dispensation that in bearing children, ultimately the seed of the covenant are brought forth. And the seed of the covenant, when it's finally fulfilled, will bring Jesus Christ, our husband. But that's hardly the full meaning of this term. She shall be saved in childbearing means that she will work out her salvation in the way of bearing children. That's what Paul says in Philippians 2 verse 12. Work out your salvation. How does the Christian woman, wife, work out her salvation? She works it out with being a mother. What gives to a woman greater appreciation, greater purpose? What gives to the Christian mother greater fulfillment than to be a mother? That's what God says here. It's the Christian wife. And when the Lord is pleased to give to her a child, assumes a purpose in life that's very, very profound. This is the struggle that every wife that desires to have children, but the Lord withholds children, goes through. The world talks about a biological urge. It's much more than that. It is the God-fearing yearning of the Christian wife to be a mother. To be a mother in the full sense of the word. A covenant mother. And the Christian wife recognizes that. That this is the awesome responsibility. And yet the awesome privilege. So that the purpose of her life is to be a mother. How many times doesn't that happen when a Christian wife and husband are married together and they live together in marriage and they don't have children right away? Perhaps they even decide they're going to wait a little while to have children, but they soon find out there's some vacuum in their life. There's something that's lacking. And they talk about it together, and they discuss together children and the place of children, and they realize what a privilege it would be to have a child. And when the Lord answers that prayer and fulfills that and gives to them a child, then it is the Christian wife that comes to her glory in her motherhood. I know that is in varying degrees, and I know that every mother strives, just like every father must grow and strive to become a better mother. And yet it's from that perspective of faith that even the woman that was accountable for the fall, listen to the devil, God says she shall be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith, in love, in holiness, in sobriety. Those are the virtues of a Christian mother. Those are those Christian virtues that make a woman shine in her faith, in her love, in holiness, with sobriety. That's why he says, don't let the woman adorn himself with all kinds of things, but let it be with modest apparel, with shamefacedness and sobriety. It doesn't have to be the outward emphasis of the world. But let her glow with the glorious virtues that God gives to her. And fulfilling that desire, carrying that out, then the Christian mother grows in her faith, also in being a mother. I know my wife has always said that, how her faith grew in nurturing the children. How her husband's does too, but differently. It's the wife whose faith grows in the nurturing of her children when she laughs with them and cries with them, when she prays with them, when she's frustrated and disciplines them, as she must do from day to day being a mother, her faith grows. That's why she is saved in childbearing, the nurturing of her faith when it is continuing in faith and charity, holiness with sobriety. And I'm sure that explains too why real God-fearing piety in a very special way is in our mothers. Oh, I know the piety of a father is different. But who of us doesn't look back and marvel at the piety of a mother? That's her salvation. Oh, yes. There is a nurturing, a blossoming out, a strengthening of her faith in the way of their mother.